So, my name is Caitlin Allen, and I'm here with Jim Best, interviewing about your sexual history in southwestern Virginia. So, can you tell us what it was like growing up in Greensboro, North Carolina?
Well, sure. I can tell you about how my mom used to take me to choir and to piano lessons and all the extracurricular things when I was, from the fourth grade on, engaged in special musical events. I always told everybody that I grew up in Aycock Auditorium, which is at UNCG, because I was her companion, because Dad was a pediatrician, and he was always busy, and she liked to socialize and be out. And of course, I wouldn't go dancing with my mother because I was just, you know, a wee thing, but she wanted to go to the show, while we went to concerts, and that was wonderful for me.
Yeah.
And I knew in Greensboro, when I was preschool, that I had a special attraction to a little boy. It's preschool, and we were gonna go under the house. And as I remember it, because you know, they had crawl spaces, and I think he asked me first. Honestly, I do. He says, "Can I see your pee-pee?" You know, and I said, "Well, I'll show you yours if you show me mine." Whatever. And he told his folks, and I was never allowed to see him again. So that's my first memory of, you know, looking back, because I had no idea that I was different from anybody else. I'd never heard of any kind of same-sex relationship. And then I remember, you know, looking back from a different perspective as an informed adult, what it was like in my high school. I was extremely lonely. I had one or two, really just one friend that I might visit, still going to choir practice and all the things that interested me, that Mama supported. And I would go to Steve's house, and we would just sort of look at each other. And neither one of us knew what to do or what to talk about, but we just knew we'd like to be together. Mm-hmm. And that might happen maybe three times in my whole life. That was the sum of my understanding. And I remember the ostracism or just the coldness and the out of social, any kind of social supportive environment. One morning the bell rang and all the kids were at their lockers talking about the night before, all the cool kids. And I just felt like I didn't belong on the planet. And I remember going into the auditorium, which was dark, and just crashing in a pew, in a seat, and just bawling my eyes out without understanding anything of why I was so distraught. And then I was engaged with wood carving since age 11. Every Saturday I would go to a retired industrialist home who taught me to carve wood, and then I carved the pew ends for my church, and I sang in the adult choir, and I played the piano for the high school group because I was taking piano lessons as well. So I was engaged, but sort of as a servant, not as a peer. And people seem to really value, you know, oh, you carve wood, oh, you carve a Calvin seal for the Senate office in Raleigh. Oh, you spoke and the minister designed something for you to carve. And I said, yes, I do adult things, but I'm a kid and I don't have any friends. So I couldn't verbalize that. I just knew that those things occupied me. And I would sit for hours and carve wood. And in junior high school, I carved a freeform quail with sage, and it was very realistic, and I had no plans. It was three-dimensional, and it was just something that I could do without any, you know, real worry. And I would sit for hours and hours and hours and hours every week and carve this, and then I wanted to give it to my high school, junior high school professor, choir director, because that was the place I could be successful. I was dyslexic, you know, left-handed, very backward, So my father wouldn't let me. I did a practice block, and I gave that to her, which was something simpler when I was carving with Sidney Payne. So through college, through high school, I was so sickly with asthma that I folded towels in PE, which meant, again, no competition, no status on a team. I was just the perfect wallflower. Fragile, I was in an oxygen tent. I remember two times as a child because I couldn't breathe well, and Dad would actually put me in the car and drive to Sarasota or somewhere Florida where the salt air could loosen me up, and we wouldn't spend the night. We would just walk on the strand and come home. Remember spending hours in the bathroom with all the hot water turned on so that I could breathe better. So when I went to college, maybe I'm getting beyond your question.
Oh, no, that was the next question I was going to ask
okay.
you. Was about college.
So when I went to college, it was like, whoa, look at this. I can meet people. And I had a couple of encounters. You know, we camped out one time with another gay guy, and that was very new for me. And in college, I went out for cross country because I didn't know any team sports, and I had a very handsome, wonderful guy that sort of took me under his wing, and I would do anything for Duke. And he was very heterosexual, but he just sort of shepherded me along, and that was glorious. I mean, he didn't mind touching me. He would put his arm around me. He says, "Come on, Jim," you know. So I ran cross country and with somebody, you know, physical in a boyish way, because I never felt that I really qualified to be a male. I could never measure up. And then when I was 24, my first cousin, who was very handsome, a dancer, he was an Eagle Scout, he was maybe a class president, and he was gay. At governor's school, you know, how many accolades can one, you know, very handsome, macho guy accrue? And he committed suicide. And I had been to stay with him and his lover in Washington, you know, like the season before, and then he came down to our home, and then like for treatment or some issue, and when he went back to 14th Street, his apartment, he jumped out the window. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm the nobody. Why couldn't I be the one to end my life when Billy was such a fantastic person? So I've lived with that question in my mind for so long, and I was basically coerced out of ignorance to read the script that society would give me as a gay person to be straight. So I tried very hard to fall in love with different girls, and it was always a wonderfully platonic thing. I remember driving this one girl. Oh, we would just drive through the countryside for hours and hours, and finally, you know, the tank of gas would give out, and I'd take her home because I didn't have any interest in doing what guys do in the car when they go out driving at night. None at all. And I remember when I went to Affirmation, which is a 33-year-old support group for LGBT Mormons, out and in Mormons. And my brother in Greensboro would take me to the airport. When I got back, he said, "Well, where have you been?" I said, "Well, I've been to Salt Lake." "Well, what'd you do in Salt Lake?" "Well, I went to Affirmation." "Oh, what's that?" "It's a support group for LGBT people." Silence. I said, "Well, you don't make any response." He said, "Well, duh." I said, "Well, what do you mean, duh?" He said, "Do you realize I grew up with you, brother?" I said, "So?" He said, "Do you know that you have never made a comment about a female in your whole life?" I said, "You're right." So my family understood, but I didn't understand. And my mother had always said, "Jim, I love your brother and I love your sister, but you are special. And I'm the oldest." And I think that she didn't really know how to say what she meant, and I didn't understand what special meant. But I'm guessing that she did. And years later, you know, I knew Mama was dying. She'd taken prednisone. She was become sedentary. She was not as oriented as she had been. And I tried to, well, I came out to her very formally. And I said, Mom, you know, I tried my best to be what you all expected of me, what society expected of me. I survived a 30-year marriage. And before we were married, I introduced my wife to be to my graduate school lover. And I said, Neil, this is Peggy. Peggy, this is Neil. Neil and I wore rings. We wore the same shirts. We were a number. And this was in graduate school. But, you know, Neil and I are not together anymore. And that's the end of it. And so that's all we considered. And that's honestly all that I understood. And so it was a huge revelation to her family that I had introduced Peggy to Neil, and that she, in her understanding, had an opportunity to know from the very before the beginning. And so I told my mom that, you know, I'd done my best, and that I didn't have any problems with Peggy as a person. She's a wonderful mother, but that there was just no relationship. We lived married to an institution and not to each other. We were both committed to being faithful partners in a marriage. So she quoted Galatians 3:6 or whatever it is, that in Christ there's no slave nor bond, Jew nor Gentile, male or female. And when I told her, she spit that out just like that, which is one of the welcoming verses in the Bible. So she was able to speak with me privately, and after all of these years, like 40 years later, she was able to say to me, well, your dad didn't like all the boys, some of the boys you brought over, especially one. Well, that was Neil. I said, yes, he was a little affected. But it took that long before she was able to share any kind of response at all. It was like, hello, and that was it. And so I always felt like, you know, there was a white elephant in the room or a rainbow elephant in the room, and they couldn't. And I remember something about, my dad asked me one time, what is 69? And I said, well, and I described the position. He said, I never would have guessed. And he said, you know, something about Billy. And I said, well, Dad, you know, Billy and I spent a weekend together, and I'm gay, and Billy's gay. He said, just never tell. That was the end of the conversation. So no empathy, no support, just like, don't ask, don't tell. That's the family I grew up in after a suicide and after bringing, you know, my peers home with me from time to time, because Neil's family was very welcoming, and it was like a holiday just to walk in their house because they wanted to know about me, they wanted to talk to me, but not my own family. My sister, who was just 17 months younger than me, were sitting with Mom at breakfast, maybe 6 months ago, and I had decided, you know, no more doormat. I know from my reading and from my spiritual affirmation and from getting reading voluminously, I bet I've got 100 books, and going to conferences, that I am not broken. And that I have a right to explore my identity and to celebrate who God made me to be as much as any other person. And so I decided that if there was something that I wanted to tell a neighbor, a cohort at work, family, that I would tell it. So I was talking about pride, because I basically rekindled PFLAG after it had died in Floyd County several years ago. And it was something that was really important. I'd invested tons of time, and we found some resonance in the community, and was really excited to talk about it. And she just, I call it a persimmon smile. She, you know, twisted up her face and she said, "Well, I don't believe in that." You know, like she's spitting out poison. And so she's very religious. And I said, "Well, you know, I've met other people that have those feelings, that have expressed those feelings, who have expressed that opinion." And so that was the end of it. And so later my mom said, "Jim, I was really proud of you for not jumping down your sister's throat." But that was the conversation, mm-hmm. period. So now that mom's gone, I will be able to say to my sister, "I understand where you're coming from, because I felt the same way as a self-hating, you know, gay man, because that's all that I knew from the environment that I grew up in. But now I have learned some other things. Would you be interested?"
Yeah. So, would you say that, you know, you said your family was generally not necessarily unwelcoming, but not welcoming of the people that you had brought home, of the men that you had brought home. Would you say that that was the climate of your overall environment where you'd grown up? And
absolutely. I didn't know any other gay people except my cousin. Mm-hmm. And even then, well, there was a community at UNCG.
Right.
Even in the 70s, because that was when I got my graduate degree in 72. 1972. So, and there were, and then the professor who over the department was a lesbian, and her partner was a secretary. So that was the visibility. To me, it was, but still there were very few peers. Growing up, none whatsoever.
So, you were saying, you know, your college years, and you said you graduated in 1972, and so what would you say?
Well, that was from graduate school.
Right, right.
Okay.
From graduate school in 1972, and so, you know, there was obviously a lot of things happening at that time and previously, you know, in the world, so how would you say that those affected you in...
Good question. You know, high school ended in 74, and Wake Forest in... 64, and in 69 I spent an extra year getting another master's degree because I couldn't graduate in biology. That was the year of Stonewall.
Right.
It was totally not on the map. Even though I had tried to meet a few people on campus, and they were all basically unpleasant, not supportive, that they wouldn't fly. I was still determined to be. I pledged a fraternity, and I was a chorister for the fraternity, and so I actually, you know, found a girl that I could take to a hotel, and of course, she'd been safe as she'd taken her mother to the hotel, and it was very distressing to me that, you know, I couldn't understand, and you know, then I was so disturbed that I went. Saved my money from working at a military academy, and oh, the young men there were gorgeous, and they loved me to death, and I took them all around the country to visit their families, but still, it was totally platonic, and so I was just beyond any solution. So I had saved my money from working at the military academy. I taught general biology, anatomy and physiology, and general science, and I had a radio club. And so I bought a bicycle in Paris and cycled to Normandy and spent a year cycling through France and Germany and Italy and Spain and Sardinia and Corsica, and worked in Denmark and applied for graduate school from Denmark, trying to get out of the milieu of this white elephant world that I was living in. Mm-hmm. And I did have two very unfortunate experiences. No harm, but total rejection for the people I met along the way. So I preached to myself, if you want a relationship, you've got to be in a community where you have time to develop it, not a bicycler you know, working odd jobs.
Right.
So that was my plan in coming home.
So would you say that your time in Europe helped you to maybe understand who you were as a gay man a little bit more when you came back to the United States, or would you say?
Well, it was more frustrating to me. Of course, I wanted to see everything, and it was a great adventure, traveling to Chartres and going to the Prado and learning Spanish and getting by in French, and all that's, you know, great when you're 24. But no, I was much more frustrated, but I was more determined. Right. I think I had become more self-reliant, and I knew that I just had an affirmation that things were going to get better without any other input of any kind. I still had no counselor or any other personal contact.
So now, what brought you to Floyd, where you live now? Would you say that had any influence when you moved to Floyd?
I didn't move to Floyd, actually. I moved to Patrick County, and we lived in Ararat because I met the supervisor of special ed at a speech conference, and I told her, you know, that I like to ride a bicycle. I wanted to work in a place far enough from Greensboro that I wouldn't be in my parents' back pocket, but that I could go home, socialize, whatever, and I love the mountains. She knew Dorn Spangler. She said, this is where you need to go, Patrick County. Well, it's one of the most conservative. It's got 16,000 people, about the same size as Floyd. It's got two stoplights now. Floyd has one. So I lived in Ararat near Peggy's family, and in the second semester, screening all the kindergarten children for speech, I met Peggy. She invited me to come to her home for supper that very first day, and within 6 weeks, we had proposed, and in six more weeks, we were married. And her family was close by in Westfield, the North Carolina farming family.
So what was it like being married to Peggy?
Well, we both had the best of intentions, and we both tried really hard to be loving. And initially, you know, we found some physical gratification in each other, but not on our wedding night, which doesn't prove anything. So we had a child, and we loved Josh, you know, beyond measure. But, you know, there was still this huge emptiness, and she got sicker and sicker, and hysterectomy, and lost all of her femininity, as far as I could tell, and didn't want to be touched, and I just went crazy. And so I was living as a monk. I was celibate for 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's when I took up the shakuhachi as a meditative instrument in the Japanese Zen tradition, and then actually went to play with a group in Washington and played with them for 10 years. And so I've got, you know, go ahead if you have a question.
Oh, no.
Okay.
Just tell me a little bit more about what it was like. I mean, you know, you said you were living almost as a monk, so how was that?
I was very much.
How was that,
celibate?
You know, affecting on...
Well, it's like living in a vacuum emotionally. Because I was a Mormon, and I was ward mission leader, which means I was in charge of meeting all the young men that came through. I was scoutmaster, so I had another crop of young, beautiful boys with their families who loved me because I was a wild hare. If they wanted to go camping, we'd go, and every month of the year we went camping. I took them to all the high adventure bases. We did scuba diving in Isla Morada. We went to Philmont. We went the Boundary Waters in the summer and back to the Ukpik program in the winter, 25 degrees below zero. They loved me to death. I would take individuals. I took my first Eagle Scout kayaking through the Everglades. He was 20 in his early 20s. And, you know, I took another gorgeous kids that I just loved to death. I'd have just, you know, fallen in love with them. But it was totally platonic, no incidents of any kind. And another boy who's just crazy about me. And we went kayaking through Lake Powell and camped every night together, and with no incidents of any kind. And then another young man, I went back to the Everglades a second time. It was just, you know, and so we still communicate, and I've come out to them, and now they're you know, big Mormon daddies, and they just love me. They still do. I played violin with one young man whose mother was a pianist, and he still, after 30 years, we still correspond. And his kids, you know, he sends me a Christmas card because, you know, we really care for each other. But that's all it was.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I had fierce crushes on kids since the first grade when I was with other boys.
Right.
And I can still remember their faces and how I just pined for them and would look at them. And I'll never forget the young man who played trumpet. He was captain of the football team. He was Mr. Everything, and his sweetheart, you know, was queen of the ball, and he was class president. And he came over to me and he said, "Let me help you with this problem." And I thought I would melt in the chair. I'll never forget that. So, you know, looking back, I can see all of these things, but at the time it was just terribly disturbing. And so you asked me about Patrick County. So I came to Patrick, married, spent 30 years there. After the divorce, I had bought land because I wanted a farm.
Mm-hmm.
And Peggy was sickly, and she was raised on a farm. She wanted to have anything to do with a farm. She didn't even know where it was. And I had paid for two pieces of land, and so when it came time for us to divorce, I said, "You take the house, your daddy built it, I'll take the land if that's agreeable." We had a no contest separation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened. So I had no place to live, I had a farm.
Mm-hmm.
So that may not be germane to our conversation, but
no, that's perfectly.
So basically, I moved, you know, I think five times in 4 years with everything that I owned in the back of my Volkswagen from one, you know, trailer to another. And I found somebody with a house, and I would just stash my stuff there until the roof caved in, and then I'd move it out. So I was a nomad, you know. I house sat for a year, just totally, you know, no culture. I'd lost all the support from the Mormons, because I was not going to apologize, and I was not going to be two-faced. And they said, "Oh, you have to come to our meeting. You've moved into our area." I said, "That's fine, but you have to understand that I am proud to be a gay man, and if that's a problem, then I don't belong." And they never contacted me again. So I began to build, and in 9 years, I moved into my place the same day Obama moved into the White House. So we were married in 74 and divorced in 04.
And how did Peggy take the divorce, and how did the people around you
Well, it was like, you know, like I said, I was living in a vacuum. So when, like, this little hole comes in, you know, I go, and it's like complete evacuation from everything in my environment. There's no church, I didn't see the people, I didn't visit, there was no continuing contact, which showed me that all of those relationships were based on an ideology and not a genuine friendship, because I could not be myself. And so it's really, I date my birth to my divorce. And I'm a totally different person than I was then. Completely different person. I spoke to faculties for nursing homes, nursing staff, delivered workshops as a speech pathologist, but not as a whole person. And so I began to visit the MCC in Winston. I played the piano and organ for them. I played my violin for them. I began to come out and not just among LGBT people, but express myself. And sort of an indication of that, not wanting to be seen, feeling that I'm not worthy of any influence or a social significance, I avoided colors. I did not want to wear any bright colors. And so, especially I hated blue, because that was the male color that I could not have. It was like my enemy, because I couldn't be boy blue, so I hated it. And I made this after Mama died, because I said to myself, you're as much of a male as any other male needs to be. And so I have adopted blue, and I've got blue here, and I've got red, and do you think what difference does color make? Well, color means everything to me. And so after a few years, I went to a retreat in Baltimore or near Maryland that Affirmation had sponsored, and a gentleman from Provo, Utah came. Neither one of us knew anyone there, and it turns out that he was a former department head of the Department of Art and Design at California Irvine for 14 years. He had a multi-million dollar budget. He had traveled all over the world with his students. He was a Mormon and a grandfather. Mm-hmm. And we became partners. And he had severe kidney issues from taking too much ibuprofen. We were together 147 days, and I was his pallbearer. And so John gave me the scholastic, artistic benchmark for my own skills, and to say, Jim, you have innately what I've spent a lifetime teaching, trying to teach my students, your perception of color and proportion, form, and aesthetic sensitivities are way beyond anything that, you know, I would encounter. Only he could say that. And it wasn't because, you know, so it was just constant spin. And he was older than me, older than I was, but so I had that really mountaintop experience, and he helped. He's a fantastic draftsman. He had four extremely successful children and a wife who was a sculptress in her own. She was an institution of her own. So John was very anemic. He went back to sort through all the original art that he had acquired over the years. The sculptor Trevor Southey was his good friend, and he asked me to please bundle up what I cared for, that it was going home with us. And he had come from Provo, and we rented a cabin together, and it was just, you know, our blue heaven. So, well, you probably don't know that song.
So you'd say John, I mean, was the mountaintop experience for you, you said. And so how, looking back on all of these experiences through your life, how would you say that these people have shaped you into the person you are? And not only the people that you had mentioned, but I mean, society as a whole as well. I mean, how...
Okay, I need to put a few pieces together for you. So John died, and I was worse off in a way, because I saw that it was possible, but it didn't exist anymore. And I was getting older, and the quality of person that I met in John, I had never met before and had no hope of ever meeting again, because I didn't party. I loved to go dance, but I always go by myself. Mm-hmm. Like, I would go from Ararat to get on 77 and drive 2 hours to Charlotte, 3 hours, and dance until 1 o'clock in the morning and get my car and drive home by myself. That was the end. That was my social life. Where I'd get in the car, go to Pier 21 or whatever it was in Greensboro, and dance by myself for 3 hours, get in the car, and drive home. Because I wasn't interested in one-night stands. I had no confidence in myself sexually, and I wasn't going to risk some, you know, stupid STD. So that's as far as I could see. So I was, you know, under a rock. I had pretty much written off the human race. And then there were a rash of suicides in Minnesota in the Anoka Hennepin school system, where Michelle Bachman and her lovely husband, who promoted reparative therapy. And it hit me like a, you know, it completely wiped me out. And so I had this message, and it came to me, and it literally knocked me out of bed. And the message was, you have a voice, and you're not using it. And that was very humbling. So I quit, you know, the pity party, and I quit the wound licking, and I got myself dressed, and I put on a tie, and I went to the fundamentalist church at the end of my driveway, and I began to ask questions, and I got the movie, and I went to workshops and found out what was available. I began to read books, and to make myself an instrument for conversation, to open minds, to ask questions, to find a way to be neighbor in a constructive way to the most homophobic people that I was living with. And I showed this very typical illiterate, computer illiterate, basically he didn't read, Baptist minister a DVD called For the Bible Tells Me So, which chronicled Gene Robinson's life and the Gephardts, their gay daughter, and many others. Desmond Tutu speaks on it, you know, Nelson Mandela. I mean, it's a documentary. It talks about the biological ideology of sexual orientation. I went online and showed him the testimony that I think his name is Burns, and I chide myself for not being able to remember, but he's I think it was Houston City Council, and he came out and he showed the pictures of these kids who were abused and bullied, and they took their own lives. And I'll never forget the comment that this man's wife made to me when I asked her how did she relate to the suicides, and she pursed up her mouth and she gave me this, you know, condescending, those parents should have been more schooled in the gospel. So basically she was laying their sexuality at the parents' feet without any understanding that some of those kids were bullied because their parents were same-sex. Some of them were committed suicide because they were perceived, and they weren't actually. They were straight kids. And so that whole misinformation of that comment just drilled into me all the assumptions and the misunderstandings that could bring her to say it was a matter of their righteousness that caused them to be. And of course, some of the parents didn't have a clue. They came home and found their kid dead. They didn't even know there was a problem. So that really fueled what's led to a new life for me. And when I began to research support organizations, I had heard that there had been a PFLAG in Floyd. I researched it. I went online. There was no record of it. And just by talking to people, oh, yes, the Quakers did it. I didn't even know there was a Quaker group. Where is it? I couldn't find it. They weren't on the web. So I finally found it. It was like a gold mine. And they accepted me. I met Kim. I talked about PFLAG. They did not as a group sponsor it, but individuals there had sponsored it and others. And so I asked if we could have a web presence. And so now Floyd Friends Meeting is listed with gaychurch.org, and they're listed in the cloud, and they're listed on the gay yellow pages. And that was great because we have several lesbians in the group. Mm-hmm. And so from there, I began to ask questions, and I had a gay young fellow and his mother who really wanted to start PFLAG, so the three of us started over.
Wow.
And so that, because I did not want to drive to Floyd. My work is in Stewart, and it's 20 miles both ways, 30 minutes drive. Mm-hmm. So it's just as good one as the other. And I had been the president of the Ruritan Club. Well, this is the stodgiest, most conservative, most entrenched, traditional group of closed-minded people you will you know, this is what keeps Metazidan isolated in the 50s, which is fine. That's their choice. And some of the folks, you know, I would say isolated, I've sort of lumped them too generally, were very perceptive, but they were not willing to buck the crowd. In fact, some of the members left when I became president because they knew I was gay. Yeah. So I endured that for a year, and then I withdrew my membership and said, I need to go where I can make a difference. And now, 4 years later, they are looking into grants. They're looking into the things that I asked them to look at when I was there. And finally they're saying, you know, so that's fine. Everybody in their own time. But in those 4 years, we're planning our fourth Pride. And I'm meeting with the Diversity Club faculty advisor Wednesday in Florida. I got to tell Madison while you were out. And we're offering a $1,000 scholarship. And we've been in the newspaper, and we've had folks from Equality Virginia come in, and Hampton Roads has always held their huge multi-million-dollar Pride the same weekend we did. But this year, the town father said, you're going to have your Pride on the 18th. That leaves our weekend open, so Equality Virginia is coming en masse, and we will have more outside presence to help us.
Which is excellent. And so you really have done a lot for Floyd P. Flag and, you know, sort of building it to what it is now. And so, you know, you're in the news as an advocate, basically, for gay rights. I mean, you go online and you're there.
Okay, your Facebook counts as news.
Yes, it does.
And I, you know, when we had the, we've given it three times prizes at the Mardi Gras in Floyd, and always before, you know, I'm the wallflower. I still don't feel comfortable speaking before people. And so this Floyd P. Flag, my secretary left, and I was the only one there. And I've supplied the prizes every year anyhow. And so, Floyd P. Flag, let me hear it for Floyd. And I was wearing old, you know, I was a Banksy character, if you know about Banksy.
Mm-hmm.
You are so cool. Because I just come from Israel and Pakistan, and I really championed, I call it the bouquet thrower.
Yeah.
If you know that. That's who I was. I had a huge bouquet of flowers. And so I asked them, you know, I was going to interact. I was going to be cool. And if they didn't know who Banksy was, that's their problem. I said, who can tell me my character? And they knew it. And that's Floyd.
Yeah.
So it went well.
Yeah.
And we had the contest, and I narrated. And so that was a huge thing for me by myself to stand up and say yes. And the devil take the hindmost. You have open way here. Fill it. And so it's just been like that. I can tell you about visiting this Seventh-day Adventist, the Jehovah's Witnesses, the two black churches, all with very positive responses.
Wow.
And confident, and come back and sing. And I've sung in their choirs.
Wow.
In the 2 years that I've been visiting the different congregations. And now another PFLAG has asked me about my work in the churches. And so she says, Jim, we are People of Faith for Equality in Virginia. And Robin Gorslein came up, who was the founder of that, and he was part of our Pride 2 years ago. And we went and delivered a letter to the clerk of court. And I delivered it in front of the WDBJ cameras. And I'm thinking, who was that? And it's like, he says, Jim, there are two responses that you'll get. One of two. You'll have a very clear welcome, or you'll have a deer in the headlights.
Right.
Well, guess what we had?
What did you have?
We had a deer in the headlights. And he's standing there just like Boss Hogg, frozen to the wall. It was so funny. And the funny thing was, he knew we were coming. He had worn a purple shirt. And it was like, he's going to be welcoming and affirming because he's going to wear a pink shirt or whatever. And he just like deer in the headlights. It was so cool. So Robin has retired with his partner Robin, Jonathan. And so others have taken over. So I knew him, and we're good buddies. And so folks have added People of Faith for Equality in Virginia to Equality Virginia as another group, a subgroup. And so now they're asking me about what I'm doing in Floyd County. And I'm saying, well, you know, I went to the Reformation Project, which is Matthew Vine's, you know, brainchild. He's a 24-year Harvard dropout who wrote a book that's been all over. If you haven't seen it, it's God and the Great Christian. Have you seen it? Sure enough. So he recruits these, you know, world-class people to come and speak. Allison Robinson, a transgender, you know, superb speaker, minister, and David Gushy, who teaches at Mercer, and he's, I think, president now of the Evangelical Society of America or some, you know, big stuff. I don't really know, but I mean, we're friends on Facebook. Mm-hmm. So I went to two of their conferences, and the whole purpose of the conference is to school yourself. We have role playing. You're going to be the evangelical. You're going to give me this pushback. You're going to quote the scriptures, and I'm going to take a positive response. And we have these workshops to learn the facts.
Right.
And so I went through that at some great expense to myself, you know, Atlanta and Washington. And so I said, you don't have to go far away. And so I'm listening to this inner teacher, and just like the spirit that knocked me out of bed and said, you have a voice. It's so very tender to remember that. And so I don't ever really know where I'm going to go or who I'm going to meet, but I have a very clear direction.
Which is absolutely amazing. I mean, that is...
You ask Kim. She went with me to the Seventh-day Adventist.
Yeah. I'll make sure to ask her.
Okay.
Yeah,
that'll be cool. I think she'd enjoy telling me.
I would love to hear about it.
Yeah.
You know, I guess one of my final questions for you is, you've done so much to put Floyd PFLAG up, and, you know, for yourself, you've come such a long way. And so how is it advocating for gay rights in such a conservative area? I mean, it's got to have its rough patches, I'm sure, and I know that you are
the
man for the
learning,
job.
In learning that in truth I was them at one time, to consider myself in their shoes and to not engage in an emotional ping pong match, mm-hmm. and never to bash scriptures, but to find common ground as a passing peer, because I'm not afraid to ask a question. I'll give you one little example. I decided I have to get out. I have to meet people. So I went to the community chorus. Hello, I live on a beautiful farm. Have you seen pictures of my place?
Yes.
Okay. So I'd never leave the place. So I said, okay, you love to sing, go to the community chorus. Who do I meet? You know, one time in the Messiah practice, she comes in. Hello, I'm an alto, da, da, da. So I meet her in the grocery store that very night. Very first time I'd ever met her. Well, gee, I just met you. That's cool. You know, how do you like the chorus? How long you been in Floyd? You know, I learned how to introduce. Well, you know, I'm president of Floyd PFLAG. What's that? It's the oldest support group we have for LGBT people. Oh, I'm so sorry. You know, you're going straight to hell. And I said, well, you know, I've heard that feeling expressed before. Tell me about yourself. Well, I was a professor of biology at one of the universities in California, and I retired from the biology. Did you realize, have you ever heard that the incidence of left-handedness is 40% greater in gay men? You show me that proof. I want to see the scientific evidence. I'd love to share some things with you. So, hello, do you think I have resources? I've got a book written by a law student from BYU, being Mormon, that really rang a bell. Did he get excommunicated? I said, no, actually, he didn't. He is now, because he chose to stand up, but not when he wrote the book. A straight BYU student's perspective on homosexuality. Or is homosexuality a gay straight... a straight BYU student's perspective. It's got 574 references.
Wow.
And it's a brilliant work. And I had it spiral bound and enlarged and gave it to our representative, Morgan Griffith, in Congress, our representative in Congress, when I lobbied with Floyd PFLAG. I mean, with PFLAG National in 2011. Yeah. And I gave one to Warner and Webb, who were our senators, mm-hmm. so that if they really wanted to read, and I had been so many times to speak to the field rep for Morgan Griffith, who is awful. He's a coal man. We're going to burn coal till hell freezes over. We don't want that climate stuff, and we do not need gay people in our schools. And that's the end of his, you know. So I went to talk to his field rep, and I was really, you can imagine, me and a woman I'd never met. And I said, you know, I've come to talk to you about something that's very important. It's really a matter of life and death. And I was not fluent with her. I turned red as a beet. I said, this is so important to me, I've just got to get it out. And so I talked to her about suicide. I talked to her about, and I went back and I talked to her again. And I talked to her a third time. And because, you know, she'd have a field office in Galax, or it would be in Stewart, to the courthouse, whatever. And the fourth time, she said, Jim, I have a question for you. She said, I'm on the finding committee for my Presbyterian church. Do you have anything that would inform me? I said, as a matter of fact, Jack Rogers, the former moderator of the Presbyterian Church U.S., wrote a book, The Bible and Homosexuality. Really? I said, oh, yes. It's very scholarly, well-documented. I gave it to my mother to read. I said, would you like her copy? No, I'll get my own. Came back to see her another time. Well, gee, Angie, how did that go? Well, she said, well, let me just tell you about it. I only had one question of the interviewees. Well, what was your question? How do you relate to the LGBT community? I said, well, what responses did you get? She said, well, they beat around the bush, or they said, you know, we don't support that. And he said, we had one guy who said, we need to welcome all of our neighbors and learn to love each other. I said, well, how did the committee respond? He got the job. And then she pointed at me and she said, Jim Best, I'm giving you credit for that. So that was another high point where, getting over my, defeatist attitude, brought a church closer to acceptance and may have helped some kid. And I could never have done that. I couldn't have orchestrated any of those factors. I just followed the inner teacher, the spirit said, get your butt over there and sit down and wait for that woman and just talk to her. Just like I passed the the Jehovah's Witness Church, and I said, Lord, don't send me down there. Those people hate my guts. And the spirit said to me, this is the truth. Now, y'all can think I'm a wacko. You knock on the door and I'll take it from there. So my job was to get out of my car and walk to the door and knock on the door. And I'm saying, okay, I've done my job. They about shook my hand off, and I sang their hymns. They invited me back. So many of them are first and second generation from Rwanda. And so we have all of this instant camaraderie. They try to come out and preach to me, and I'm reading their scriptures, you know, in Romans, and they say, well, you know, we have the most accurately translated scriptures in the entire world. I said, well, that's very interesting. Did you realize that you're using a word that wasn't even invented until the 1800s? Oh, is that right? It has nothing to do with the original Koine of the New Testament or Hebrew, because those words and those concepts didn't really exist in those cultures. Really? I said, well, yes, honestly, homosexuality is not a New Testament concept, and sexual orientation is not addressed in any form in the scriptures. Only behavior is discussed. Oh, well, I need to do some more homework. And that was the end of this. That was the end of it. So when we see him on the street, how you doing, Jim? Same thing with the Assemblies of God. Oh, buddy. And his brother. Did I know this? No, I didn't. But I see the sign. Everybody just gnaws at me when I go by. I said, okay, all right. Next Sunday I'll go there. Go in. There's like five people in the whole congregation. I sing with them. He comes by and shakes my hand. Buddy, I really chaw down on that hand, and I want him to know I'm serious business. And I said, you know, Clyde, why I'm here? Well, no, why are you here, Jim? I said, I've come to be neighbor. I've come to learn how to be neighbor to you and your congregation. And I said, you know, frankly, some of us are harder to love than others. And he just dies laughing. And I said, Clyde, sometime I'd love to speak with you. So we have this hour and a half conversation, just him and I. And he's never heard this information before. No one has ever, he's never heard someone say, I'm grateful for the sexual orientation that I have. His brother is chairman of the school board. Did I know that? No. And so I go back and I sit down in their fellowship hall and they're having fried chicken and, you know, please join us for lunch. Great. I sit down, don't know the lady. His daughter-in-law is a social worker. Worked in Montgomery County. Jim, I understand. She gets it. She's worked with the at-risk kids. She knows sexual orientation. She knows that we don't help them by condemning them. She welcomes me to bring her the Youth Risk Behavior Survey. I write OCR, Officer of Civil Rights. I said, this survey is intrinsically flawed because it doesn't ask questions that relate to at-risk communities. It only asks male or female. How are you going to differentiate the at-risk kids if they can only choose between, you know, the gender dichotomy? Guess what? OCR writes me back and says, you're right. And we're talking to the CDC. We're going to add two questions to the survey next year. Now, that wasn't because I asked them, but it happened that they had already been working on it, apparently, and there's a long list of stuff that I discovered because I asked the question.
Wow.
And so that went on our conference call with PFLAG National. They're working on generating a survey, not just in defining the demographics, but also in the interpretation. So they had racial numbers, certain percentage of black, certain percentage are mixed, certain percentage, they had all that.
Right.
They had male and female, but all the results are tabulated without any indicators. So they don't know if more females than male. 33 attempted suicides in just the 50% of the kids who identified themselves as A and B students. Well, what does that tell you about the kids who weren't so successful academically? Nothing. What is their risk? More? Maybe so. And that's only in two grades. So they could have defined the results by a racial profile. They could have said, well, you know, our minority kids are three times more likely for ideation or for self-injury or for attempted suicide. And there were three different questions. They don't know. And the heinous part of it is the results are all tabulated verbally. I think I've presented this. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And the verbal description was slightly above the national norm. It's 178% of us. So anyhow, I won't beat you over here with that. But so I know we've spent a long time. Is there anything else I need to...
I mean, your story is just... It's incredible. I mean, really, you are an incredible person. And I thank you so much for sharing with us, you know, just everything. And yeah, thank you so much, Jim.
Well, thank you all for being so prepared. Yeah.